Did you want to have a few words to say, Pat? Did you want to say a few things about Frankfurt Historical Society? I thought you...
I'm Patricia Coyne. I have a chapter daughter of the American Revolution here in Frankfurt. We were founded in 1903 by descendants of Betsy Ross, and we meet to this very day. We, for many years, met at the Frankfurt Historical Society, and in doing some research about Betsy Ross, I found that her roots go very far back into Philadelphia's Frankfurt area, from Thomas Chalkley on to Ada James, and then on to Samuel Griscom. Debbie Clack is the executive director of the Frankfurt Historical Society, and she's also embracing the research about Betsy Ross's ties to Frankfurt. So I wanted to extend to any and all of you an invitation to consider, if you have a patriot who was around here during the American Revolution, if you'd like to consider membership in my house, VAR, please do not hesitate to ask. And I don't know if Debbie has something else to add about the Frankfurt Historical Society?
The Historical Society is 101 years old this year, and as Pat said, the roots are from Frankfurt and all her ancestry. We are so proud to embrace this, and met John Harper by email and phone, and this is a wonderful thing that is going on. I just want to, you're not taught your history lessons in school, you're not taught the whole picture of Betsy Ross, and I think we have a great opportunity today with John Harper. So thank you, and if you ever want to visit us, we are located in Frankfurt. Membership, I didn't bring any information on it, I'm sorry. I didn't expect to stand up here and talk. But John, I thank you for letting the Historical Society sponsor this.
Thank you, yes.
John, can I also add that we have Laurie Reck here, who is the director of the...
Yes, House. Yes. Laurie, executive director of Betsy Ross House. Mm-hmm. And I have family members here, which I'm sure some of you have already met, and I'm happy to have my son and my grandson up there on the projector, and I'm pleased that my son kind of worked me through my speech so that maybe we won't go too far astray. But as it says, I'm John Ballerston Harker, fifth generation, and I was in the third grade when I was asked to play George Washington in a little flag skit, and it seems that I went home and told my folks, and they said, well, you're descended from Betsy Ross. Wow, okay. And that was the end of that until about 1995, when the Wall Street Journal published an article. It came to my attention. My cousin brought it to my attention. It was published June 12, 1992. Tale of Betsy Ross, it seems, was made out of whole cloth. The grandson spun a tale, sold it to America, now part of the nation's fabric. I tried to get in touch with Valerie Reitman. That was my first move, and she had been moved to L.A. and then from there to Tokyo. I don't know what that implied, but at any rate, I had to begin to check this out, because she and her story was giving some credit to Francis Hopkinson, which was a new name to me, and I had to get in touch with Whitney Smith, who was a flag guru, and find out who is Francis Hopkinson, and he put me on the track to find out who Hopkinson was. But tonight, we're going to give you the answers that I've turned up in these 6 years. So my talk tonight, really three segments, a current theory about how some of our flag, I'm going to talk about the theory that our flag was designed by Francis Hopkinson, and I hope to debunk that. Then I'm going to talk about the Weisgerber painting of 1893 and how that made Betsy Ross a myth, a mythological figure. And then I'm going to talk about the factual evidence that we have, as well as some folklore evidence, that supports the Betsy Ross story as it came down through my family. And let me say that I met a gentleman yesterday who plays George Washington and gives speeches around town and other places all over the country, really. And we had a long talk, about an hour, and he said one thing to me, Betsy Ross was not a liar. And I just want you folks to realize that. Betsy Ross was not a liar. The family story may have gotten a little convoluted as it came down through several generations, but when Betsy Ross said she made a flag for George Washington, I think we can take that as pretty much gospel. Okay, Francis Hopkinson, where does he come into this? He was a real patriot, a really intelligent guy. First brought to the attention of, flag people and historians by a 1926 biography done by a gentleman named Hastings. And we learned that Francis Hopkinson was in the first graduating class of the College of Philadelphia, 1757. In 1768, he married Ann Borden, daughter of Joseph Borden of Bordentown. Nothing like marrying good, marrying well, you know. He is first mentioned in October 1917 in the National Geographic issue called Our Flag. But they don't credit him with the design of the flag. They just mention him. And they mention him in some detail, which we'll show you. And at any rate, in that 1917 National Geographic, they picture the Circle of Stars flag, and they say, our first flag. They don't attribute it to anybody, but they say that was our first flag, the Circle of Stars flag. They also go on to say that it was customary in the Navy to arrange the stars in the 3-2-3-2-3 arrangement, and that became our second flag, in my opinion. I think two flags came out of the Revolutionary War period. Now the thing with Francis Hopkinson, the historians have a real problem getting around the Betsy Ross story because of the myth that grew up around it. And so they had to poo-poo it, they had to deny it, they had to find other ways of attributing it. To somebody else, they had to attribute the design of the flag to somebody else. Not that Betsy designed the flag, but she stitched it for George Washington, not Francis Hopkinson. But you'll find references being made that she stitched a flag that Francis Hopkinson designed. And we have to somehow get around that. The reason why the historians were able to zero in on Hopkinson was that he sent a letter to the Board of Admiralty in 1780. We have some more. Come on in and have a seat. In 1780, he had just finished work on his version of the Great Seal of the United States. And he submitted a list, if you will, of fancy work, which he called fancy work that he had done over the previous 3 years. So from about 1777 to 1780, he had been involved in numerous pieces of fancy work. And he listed these in his letter to the Board of Admiralty. The first thing on the list is the flag of the United States of America. Well, if he says he designed the flag of the United States of America, who are we to doubt that? Okay, there's how we get Francis Hopkinson. He also designed currency. He designed a seal for the Board of Treasury. And I think this is all pretty much in chronological order. Ornaments and devices for new bills of exchange, a seal for the ship papers, a seal for the Board of Admiralty, which he is pleased to say the Board of Admiralty accepted. Borders and ornaments for checks now in press. And finally, the last item, a great seal for the United States of America with a reverse. So this is in chronological order, and the flag of the United States coming at the front of the list, top of the list, would have been around 1776, 1777. And the great seal, his work was finished in 1780. He submitted his design. His design was not accepted. It went on to another committee of people. He was a consultant. Hopkinson was a consultant of the second committee. A third committee was appointed, and then the third committee's design was rejected, and Thompson, the secretary to the Continental Congress, created the final design. But let's see. When Hopkinson sent this letter, he said, all I want in the way of compensation is a half a cask of ordinary wine. They should have given him that. But he didn't. They didn't want to give him any credit or something, because they said, Well, I think you should put some value on these things that you say you want to be compensated for, and then we'll pay you. So he submitted successive accounts repeating the same list of items, and one of the accounts that he submitted had the values quoted in English pounds, and the naval flag of the United States is 9 pounds. Okay. Designs with mottos for currency, 7 pounds. All right. The Board of Admiralty, 3 pounds. Shipping papers, 3 pounds. Currency in press, 5 pounds. And the Great Seal of the United States with reverse, 10 pounds. Okay. So they said, all right. Now, in a way, show us that you were authorized to do all this work, or give us, you know, your supporting documentation. Well, he couldn't do that. And so it bounced back and forth. But let's take a look at the kind of artwork that went into some of this stuff that he claimed credit for. At the top we have the Treasury of North America. That's in Latin around the rim. And that, maybe they thought Canada was going to be part of the States, you know. On the left at the bottom, we have a 1778 Board of War and Ordnance, a seal that he did for them. And then the front of his Great Seal of the United States is shown there on the right. And that's a nice, intricate piece of work. I mean, there's a really nice piece of work. And notice this little up there at the top, they call it a radiant constellation of stars. The 13 stars are there at the top, surrounded by kind of whatever, but that's his $10 design, part of his $10 design, we don't have the reverse, for the Great Seal of the United States. Now, let's move on. $10 for the Great Seal of the United States, $9 for the naval flag of the United States. He now calls it the naval flag, he doesn't call it the flag of the United States, this is the naval flag. $10 for the Great Seal, $9 for the flag, $3 for Board of Treasury, $3 for Board of Admiralty. I looked at that and I thought, this man had a very sophisticated artistic design for a flag. But nobody had ever thought about that in any of the books that I read. Nobody had made any mention of that. So I thought, well, okay, maybe this is the first clue that his flag design was not accepted. He never makes any observation that his flag design was accepted. He never claims credit for it. In the 3 years from the time he did the flag design to the time he submitted his bill, nobody gives him any comment. There's no comment, no written record of any flag having been approved that he designed. Let's go on to the kinds of flags that did get accepted. Or that flag historians have wanted to attribute to Hopkinson. On the left, a 1961 publication by Quaife, Waig, and Appleman. They thought about this long and hard, and they came to the conclusion that Hopkinson's design was the 3-2-3-2-3 star arrangement in the blue field with the 13 stripes. Now, of course, the 13 stripes had already been confirmed by, in the very beginning, when Washington was trying to get the British out of Boston, and in January of 1776, he flew a flag with 13 stripes, red and white. So we had that as an established design. So the only design part of this flag that could be attributed to Hopkinson was the star arrangement. Is that a 9-pound piece of artwork? I don't think so. Well, Whitney Smith, who is a guru in this field, persuaded the United States Postal Service to publish a flag in the year 2000, June 14, 2000, that he labeled the Francis Hopkinson flag. He had it nailed. And he had the circle of stars, 6-pointed stars, which would have been Hopkinson. And I saw him one day and I said, now, you know, what's your supporting documentation for that flag? Well, he didn't have any. In fact, on the back of that plate of stamps, he had to say that others had different points of view as to the design. But let me ask you again, the Circle of Stars, is that a 9-pound piece of artwork? I don't think so. Hopkinson's design, if he had had a design, would have been a lot more sophisticated, a lot more complex, a lot more artistic, much more like, if you will, his work on the Great Seal of the United States. Another couple of people writing on flags, Furlong and McCandless, they didn't publish an image, but they did favor six-pointed stars because that was what his book plate had in one of the books that they looked at. So these two flags, although with five-pointed stars, came out of the Revolutionary War period, and if you wish, you can attribute one of those to Hopkinson and say that was Hopkinson's design, but he wanted 9 pounds for that design, and I don't think that I would have paid him 9 pounds for that design. This fits into my story just a little bit here. The flag resolution, John, let's go to the next slide. No, can't do that yet. The flag resolution was adopted June 14, 1777. And some historians say the flag did not exist until it was adopted. Okay, technically speaking, we did not have a flag until it was officially adopted. But on the other hand, there is a gentleman who I read who said, what is really significant is that this great historical event was in the apparent absence of comment upon it in Congress or elsewhere, either before or after its achievement, the substitution of the stars and stripes for the Grand Union flag. Washington's Grand Union flag had the British crosses up in the upper right-hand canton, and all we did was substitute the circle of stars or the arrangement of the stars. That's all we did. But this man said, the substitution of the stars and stripes for the Grand Union flag must be considered extraordinary and explicable only on the ground that there was practically unanimous agreement upon the propriety and the felicity of such action. So the point that I think he was making was that people had a long time to discuss this, and when the flag resolution was passed, there was no discussion, there was no reaction, it was almost a fait accompli, it was almost as if, we better do this, we've been talking about it long enough. Okay, I hope we can get out of talking about Hopkinson. Bessie Ross. Now, how did she become a mythological person, the mythological person that the historians had a problem with? William Canby, my grandfather's uncle and a grandson of Betsy Ross, gave a speech in 1870 to the Historical Society of Pennsylvania in which he laid out the family story, the family legend. And it would appear to me that he was merely making public what was already pretty well known to people. And yet there are other people who saw that as the first shot in terms of giving Betsy Ross credit for something. And this was an interesting time. And for that speech to have been made then, followed by the patriotic fervor that swept our country starting about 1780, 1790s, 1900, this patriotic fervor, let's have another slide there, huh? The U.S. hereditary organizations? Good, can't read them. Okay. From 1775 until 1900, there were two dozen hereditary organizations formed. You had to have been here, you had to have been a part of America for some prior time to get into any one of these. And one of them, of course, is the Daughters of the American Revolution. There was a spirit of nationalism, and we're talking now about why Betsy became a myth. There was this spirit of nationalism. Women's right to vote was being argued. America the Beautiful was written by Catherine Lee Bates. The Stars and Stripes Forever was done by John Philip Sousa. A gentleman whose name I didn't get was responsible for writing the Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag. Okay. So at any rate, we had a period of time there where we were looking at ourselves and saying, we are a unified, solid people, a good country, a proud country, and here comes this image of Betsy Ross. How did that image of Betsy Ross develop? Well, Weisgerber, Charles Weisgerber, walking down the street one day, he had just come back from Paris, where he had a year's training in art. He walked past the Betsy Ross house, which looked a little different then than it does today. And the city of Philadelphia had offered $1,000 for artwork that would depict a historical scene in Philadelphia, relevant to Philadelphia, $1,000 prize. So Charles Weisgerber got in touch with William Canby and George Canby, and they gave him the background story on the Betsy Ross situation, the family legend, and Weisgerber created a picture, 1893. You're all familiar with that picture. It was an immediate hit because it depicted Betsy Ross in a very interesting situation. One lady whom I will just say was a very important person in getting this picture salvaged had this to say about the picture. In Weisgerber's construction, all of Canby's story elements are compressed into a single miraculous moment. The committee is present as the flag is born. Betsy has made the prototype flag and it is being delivered. Washington extends his hand towards Ross's wondrous gift. Although the Honorable George Ross and Robert Morris are also present on this occasion and they too look pleased, they do not share the intimate moment with Betsy and George. The birth of our nation's flag not only told the story of the origin of the national colors, it also introduced Betsy Ross to the American public. It was this image that propagated the story of the Philadelphia Needlewoman and constructed the Betsy Ross myth in its own terms. In this image, Betsy Ross is elevated to her position of national prominence as a historic figure, the mother of the new nation, because this picture not only constructs an historic moment, it also creates an icon. Betsy Ross is not just the seamstress who assembled the original flag in this painting. She became the mother of the national emblem, which is the sacred symbol of the United States. Well, imagine now, 50 years later, you're trying to write a book on the origins of the flag, and you have to deal with that kind of an image that had captured America's heart. I don't think you can deal with it pretty straightforward. You kind of have to slap it down somehow. Charles Weisgerber raised the money to buy that house by selling these little certificates. 10 cents a piece. He printed 2 million chromolithographs. 2 million. At 10 cents a piece, that's $200,000. But he didn't pocket that kind of money. He actually, to get to this point, he decided that that would be the right thing to do to save this house. He organized a committee of prominent Philadelphia people, signatures on the bottom of that, began to sell these out at 10 cents a piece. In due time, about 3 years, they'd raised about $80,000 and they bought the house. And the expenses in connection with the printing and mailing of these was about $25,000 or $30,000. So there was another $35,000 or $40,000 there. But over the next couple of years, they had to promote this. So they traveled to different parts of the country by train, took the picture with them. So the money was reasonably well spent. But nevertheless, he raised the money to save that house through selling these little certificates, and people wanted them. And they're on the eBay, on the internet, $25 to $50 dated, you know, certificate that so-and-so contributed 10 cents and their name is on the honor roll. And that was Weisgerber's contribution. He saved that house, but he also made Betsy the myth that the historians have had a problem with. And that wasn't the real Betsy. That's not the real Betsy story. I mean, the Betsy story did not start in 1870. That was pretty much the end of the Betsy story. So let's take a look now at artistic evidence and folklore that supports the original story of Betsy Ross. Find out from the beginning if this is a myth or not. The real story. How about that, John? Is that the way it happened? Okay. I do believe that a committee called on Betsy. That was her story, and she's not a liar. The committee was Robert Morris, chair of the Secret Committee. Now, the Secret Committee was the committee that was planning for the war with Britain. They were organizing, getting materials, supplies, creating troops and the like. Robert Morris knew what the future held, and it was, in his mind, I'm sure, a unified nation. George Ross, uncle-in-law to Betsy. Betsy was a widow for 5 months. So George Ross, well-connected, brought these two men to Betsy, Robert Morris and George Washington. Now, historians have said this story doesn't hold up. There's no evidence in Washington's letters to the Board of War or others that he visited with Betsy, that he had Betsy make a flag. Washington wanted a flag for the army. And I believe these people were coming to Betsy to have a flag made that would represent the nation. But this was a month before the Declaration of Independence, so they had to do it in secret. They couldn't talk about it. And Washington's need for an army flag was consistent with the European tradition. The army had a flag, the navy had a flag, regiments had flags. And of course we did not have a United States in 1776. We had 13 proprietary colonies that had united to try to drive out the British, but they were not ready to be United States. In fact, the flag resolution uses the word United States in lower letters, no caps. It just wasn't. We had the Continental Congress, on the one hand, organizing to fight the war with Britain and maybe needing a flag for the nation. And we had Pennsylvania, we had Massachusetts, we had Connecticut, Virginia, Maryland, all these separate states, many of them developing their own flags. We had the pine tree flag and other things, you know, the rattlesnake flag. But the state of Pennsylvania had a navy in the Delaware River, and they needed a flag for the Pennsylvania Navy. The time period, June of 1776 to July of 1777, is a very interesting and critical time period, and we have practically no documentation as to what happened there. If Betsy was visited by that committee on January and June of 1776, and she undertook to make a flag, that flag could have been finished in 3 months or 6 months. certainly not in 3 days, the way the family story told it, but Betsy would have been working on that. Washington would have gone back to New York to try to fight off the British there, and of course he got whipped, and before the year was out, he was back on the south side of the Delaware River, up there in New Hope. And at any rate, over this time frame, Francis Hopkinson is appointed from New Jersey, comes to Philadelphia like June 27th to represent the state of New Jersey and in the Continental Congress. July 12th of 1776, Hopkinson is made a member of a Marine Committee. There's an 11-member Marine Committee. And, you know, guess who's the chairman? Robert Morris. By November of 76, Hopkinson and two others are the Naval Board, dealing more intimately with the problems of the Navy. Hopkinson wanted, at that point in time, he wrote to Robert Morris and said, I want the Commodore of the Continental Navy to be in charge of the Pennsylvania Navy in the Delaware River. It didn't happen. The Commodore of the Pennsylvania Navy was put in charge of the half a dozen Continental Navy ships, along with the 40 or 50 ships of the Pennsylvania Navy. Ships of all sizes, including floating barges with guns that they rowed. They didn't have sails. But Hopkinson was right there in the middle of it. And you can well imagine, and I can give him credit for saying, you know, we need a good solid flag design here. And so that would have been when his flag design would have been brought forth. And it's when the Circle of Stars flag would have been brought forth. Because when George Washington sat down with Betsy, Betsy said, you know, the flag should have five-pointed stars, not six-pointed stars. And Washington said, well, they're too hard to make. I mean, his own headquarters flag had six-pointed stars on it. And Betsy said, no, they're not too hard to make. You take this piece of paper, you fold a clip, and you've got a five-pointed star. Oh, well, then, okay, make five-pointed stars. And then Betsy said, well, now, you know, the stars should be arranged in some pattern, not just promiscuously placed on the blue field. And Washington responded by making some arrangement of the stars. And we can conclude, I believe, that it was a circular arrangement, because that circular arrangement became the symbolic flag, became the standard flag of the United States. And in fact, the 1917 publication of the National Geographic said, our first flag. So by making up that flag, shall we say, in competition with other possible flag designs, including one by Francis Hopkinson, my quote from my book, that this flag was adopted without comment. It was obvious that people had been talking about it, thinking about it, you know, making comparisons, and I think that all took place in this 12-month period. Now, the Pennsylvania Navy, the gentleman, Williams, I think his name, needed to know that there was a flag for the Pennsylvania Navy. And in August, he wrote to Morris and said, we need flags for the Pennsylvania Navy. In October, he said, the Commodore is with me, and we as yet do not have a flag for the Pennsylvania Navy. Has a design been settled upon? October of 76, has a design been settled upon for a flag for the Pennsylvania Navy? And I think at that point, somebody said, well, why don't we do this 3-2-3-2-3 arrangement of stars? You know, the circle of stars is beautiful, awfully hard to make. You have 13, they're not, you know, 360-degree circle divided by 13. You're not going to get them positioned correctly, but it's a lot easier if we make the stars in lines. And then that's where the 3-2-3-2-3 flag comes into being. And that becomes, in my opinion, the flag that was adopted for the Pennsylvania Navy. And Betsy was paid 14 pounds and change in May of 1777. And the flag resolution is passed in June of 1777. And in July of 1777, we have the first anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And the Pennsylvania Packet Reporter says, and the flag of the United States flew from the masts of the ships. Well, the bulk of the ships were Pennsylvania Navy, so he might have been looking at a 32323 flag. John Adams, who was bored of war, wrote to his daughter Abigail and makes no comment at all about flag, the U.S. flag, the United States flag on the masts of the ships. So somebody saw the United States flag on the mast, somebody else didn't. But the flag resolution, which was passed, simply says 13 stripes, red and white, a field of blue, and 13 white stars on that field of blue, representing a new constellation. Well, what's a new constellation? It was anybody's guess what a new constellation was. But 4 years later, a person working on a version of the Great Seal of the United States did a little flag, did the circle of stars, called it the flag of the United States. This is 4 years later. The circle of stars he called the flag of the United States, and that the circle represented perpetuity, unity, continuity, all those good words. Well, so much for that period of time. I think we've got to move along. What has come to light now is what I've told you was the only story that we had until recently. A gentleman named Weston Adams acquired a painting done in 1851 by a lady named Ellie Wheeler. A gentleman named Samuel Waldo did a painting of Elizabeth Claypool, 80 years old, and called it Betsy Ross. And somebody made up a little piece of folded paper with the name Pattern for Stars on it and wrote Betsy Ross on that Pattern for Stars. They also wrote the name of Betsy Ross's daughter, Clarissa Wilson. So we have a Pattern for Stars piece of paper. We have a portrait of Betsy Ross done by Waldo in 1832. We have a painting done by Ellie Wheeler in 1851. And all of these depict Betsy Ross as the flag maker and the Committee of Three. Let's take a look at the Ellie Wheeler painting. Her father was Thomas Sully, a very famous portrait painter. In 1851, now, William Canby has not given his speech, but this woman grew up in the Philadelphia area. Her life overlapped Betsy's by about 20 years. And in that 20-year period of time, we were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Revolution, and she did this painting. There's Betsy with the flag, and there's Washington, and her George Ross and Robert Morris. Curiously enough, J.L.G. Ferris, an artist of the 1910, copied that painting. So we know that painting was in Philadelphia around 1900, 1910, and Ferris copied it as his own and included that with a group of 70 portraits or 70 paintings that he called, I just forget what he called it. What did he call that? The something of America. At any rate, this picture was on display at the Betsy Ross house for 6 months, not maybe a dozen years ago, and I was fortunate enough that the collections lady at the Betsy Ross house brought this to my attention, this Ellie Wheeler painting, and the gentleman who owns it, Weston Adams, has been a real rock for me in terms of helping me get squared away with my thinking. So there was folklore that tracked this name, Betsy Ross, or something to that effect. Now, Samuel Waldo was a New York artist. And at some point in time, he must have heard something about this Betsy Ross lady, because in 1832 he looked her up, and I think she was pretty elderly, living with a daughter in Abington, and he painted her. Now, he kept that painting in his possession. It did not come down into the family. The family never knew that this painting existed. In 1975, the owner of that painting got in touch with Whitney Smith, the flag guru from Abington, Winchester, Massachusetts, and showed him this painting. And Whitney Smith published this painting in the book in 1975. The painting has since gone into somebody else's hands who wishes to remain anonymous. But on the back of that painting it says, Portrait of Betsy Ross. Here's an 80-year-old woman, and the painting is labeled Portrait of Betsy Ross. Well, Betsy Ross was Betsy Ross from the time she was 22 to the time she was 25. There's an 80-year-old woman, Portrait of Betsy Ross, 1832. How did that add up, you know? There was some folklore that identified this lady, and everybody in Philadelphia knew that folklore, and she was an important figure during the period of the Revolution, because 50 years after the Revolution, when they're all reflecting back on this, this man comes along and paints her. Now the pattern for stars. A very interesting piece. This has been in this pattern for stars has been in the showcase in this building. It is not here now. It's been put in safekeeping. It's a little folded piece of paper, and written on it is H.C. Wilson, and then Betsy Ross, Betsy spelled S-E-Y, and then pattern for stars. Now, for Wilson name to have been on that, it would have to have been done after 1812, because Wilson came home to Mama in 1812 with four or five children and worked with her mother, Elizabeth Claypool, in the flag business. So at some point in time, somebody said, show us how you make a five-pointed star. And somebody obliged. I think Hildebrand was the person, Sophia Hildebrand, I think that was the lady that obliged, because the H would suggest Hildebrand, her name was going to be on this, and she probably said, oh, no, put my grandmother's name on it, Clarissa, or my mother's name, Clarissa Wilson. Okay, so they made the H, but they didn't go any further. They reverted back to C for Clarissa Wilson, and then Betsy Ross. Well, when Wilson was born, it was Elizabeth Claypool, it wasn't Betsy Ross, but they used the name Betsy Ross in making up this five-pointed star. So the idea that Betsy was accountable, or that the five-pointed star can be attributed to Betsy, has a lot of merit just from this little simple piece of paper. Well, okay, but that's not enough. There is outside folklore now that we've identified. A lady up in Massachusetts, Rebecca Prescott, and the Prescott name is a very good name in Massachusetts, married Roger Sherman of Connecticut, and we have a story to tell about that. There is a fresco artist in Washington around 1850, in the 1850s, 1860s, who does frescoes in the Capitol building, and we have a story about that. Then we have a gentleman named Captain Williams who fought in the Revolutionary War and carried with him a Betsy Ross flag, commonly known as the Trenton flag. Well, now where did that come from? Now we have Charles Wilson Peale, who did two very significant paintings of Washington. The Rebecca Prescott story is fascinating. It was quoted by Cokie Roberts recently in a book. Am I getting feedback? No. In a book that she wrote called Founding Mothers. And I traced it back. It first appears in the Journal of American History in 1909. Well, in 1909, Americans were trying to recall the Revolutionary War period and then record everything that they could about that period. And a woman named Kate Bennett was descendant of the Prescotts, wrote the story about Rebecca Prescott. And she says in that writing that Rebecca is in Washington with her husband, in Philadelphia with her husband, and her husband is a member in the Continental Congress, and Washington tells Roger Sherman that he's having a flag made by Betsy Ross. Washington tells Roger Sherman that he's having a flag made by Betsy Ross. Now, that's the first time we ever had any folklore come down to us independently of the family folklore. So we got excited about that. And the story is being told by Kate Bennett in 1909, who's got it secondhand from, you know, down through the family. The story says that this excited Rebecca to the extent that she went down and sewed some of the stars onto that flag. She went down and looked up Betsy Ross and sewed some of the stars on that flag that was being made for George Washington. Well, all that would be hearsay, and you don't have any hard evidence. But the story continues. Kate Bennett continues the story, and she says, and then on another occasion, Rebecca and her husband were invited to dinner at the Washingtons. And Rebecca wore this green silk dress. And Washington said, come sit beside me on my right-hand side. You are the handsomest woman here. Which upset Mrs. Hancock, but Rebecca was so thrilled at that, that she saved that dress and passed it down in the family. And Kate Bennett, who was getting this story from an elderly ancestor, the ancestor says, would you like a piece of that dress? And Kate says, yes. So she got a rectangular piece of that green silk dress, and she had it stitched into the center of a quilt, the DAR chapter, Rebecca Prescott Sherman chapter in Minneapolis, 1907, made a quilt, and that piece of the dress is in the quilt. So we have that tangible fact that this story has some merit, that there is some validity to the story. We can't confirm that that Rebecca helped Betsy make the flag, but at any rate, there's an interesting piece of folklore that we had never had before. The Capitol fresco came to us through the Betsy Ross House. Somebody in the Capitol building down there in Washington said, you folks should have a copy of this. And they printed off a glass plate that they had in their file. And the glass plate depicted some frescoes that would represent the Revolutionary War period. These frescoes were never done, but the draft of them was photographed, and we got a print of that. There were four frescoes, and the fifth that never was completed, even in draft form. One of those frescoes on the screen shows a woman presenting a flag to three men. And I'm saying that's Betsy presenting the flag to the committee. We can't confirm or deny that. There's no way at all. The other three frescoes that were under consideration to go into a panel where there were four openings, a panel in the ceiling, there were four spots. They had three frescoes. They never had a fourth one, so they didn't do it. The other three would have been Molly Pitcher, Lydia Darrow, and Deborah Sampson. Deborah Sampson was a woman who dressed like a man and spent 9 months in the Army before she was found out. But those three ladies would have been in the ceiling, and if there had been a fourth lady of significance in the Revolutionary War period, she would have filled out that fresco in the ceiling. The fresco on the side wall is the one that you see up here, a woman giving a flag to three men. Now, we know a lot of regimental flags were done and given, and the regimental flags would typically have Lady Liberty giving a flag to a soldier. And this does not look like Lady Liberty giving a flag to a soldier. So this proposed fresco is just as another one of those pieces of evidence that around the time of the 50th anniversary of the Revolutionary War flag, people were still remembering Betsy Ross and the flag and the history. Now we come back to Captain Edward Williams. We don't come back to him, we come to Captain Edward Williams. He was born in Philadelphia in 1820. Well, again, this is the 50th anniversary period. So from 1820 to 1838, he lived in Philadelphia, and then he went to Harrisburg. So he would have totally absorbed the Betsy Ross story. In Harrisburg, when the war with Mexico broke out, he's 27 years old, and he organizes a volunteer group to go fight in Mexico. In the Capitol building, in the Capitol Library, the State Library of Harrisburg, is an American flag said to have been made by Betsy Ross, commonly known as the Trenton flag. And you go back to that time frame from June of 1776 to December of 76, when Washington crossed the Delaware, and it was time enough for Betsy to have finished the Circle of Stars flag and have presented it to Washington, and Washington might have had that flag when he crossed the Delaware. Emanuel Lutz drew it that way, painted it that way. Washington crossing the Delaware, standing in the boat with a flag. And of course historians say, all wrong, that flag was not approved until, you know, 1777. He could not have had that flag in 1776 December. Well, the people in Harrisburg thought they had a Betsy Ross flag that was commonly referred to as the Trenton flag. Captain Williams took that flag from the glass case in the State Library. It was on display when they had a ball going before the Cameron Guards were off to war. He carried it with him to Mexico. He flew it over the fortress of Chapultepec when they captured that fortress, and then he brought it back and gave it to the governor, and we've lost track of that flag. But the fact that he carried that flag, and that the source of that flag that he carried was written up by a Major Brindle, who was his superior, and that write-up was sent to the War Department. But the volunteer groups, when they filed action reports, they were ignored. And this was a volunteer group. Only the regular Army people, action reports, got into the files. So 50 or more years later, Major Brindle writes to the War Department and says, you know, I think my original report was either suppressed or destroyed. Here's my copy of it. And he repeats the same story of how that flag came into the possession of Captain Williams. But what is interesting is that it's known as the Trenton flag. Okay, now we go to Peel. Charles Wilson Peel. In 1779, after the Battle of Princeton, I mean, he captures the Hessians at Trenton in December 76, and 77, he has a fight with the British in Trenton, and then he goes to Princeton and he has another fight with the British in January of 77. In 1779, the Executive Council of Pennsylvania asks Charles Wilson Peel to paint Washington, and Washington is painted resting on a cannon after the battle. He has a sash. The sash is his symbol of authority. 3 years after that, what is now Princeton, then the College of New Jersey, commissioned Peel to make another painting of Washington, and Washington paid for this painting, and it was hung in Nassau Hall in Princeton around 85, I guess. And it has in the background the striped flag and five-pointed stars showing in the blue canton, and Washington has five-pointed stars on his epaulets. So the five-pointed star has become the symbol of Washington's authority. No more sash. Washington paid Princeton, gave them the money that paid the Peale for this painting. Did Washington know that this flag was behind him when the picture was painted? Did he know it was going to be painted behind him after his portrait was done? I think so. Nobody ever took exception to the presence of that flag and the five-pointed stars in the blue field. And again, this painting is called Washington at the Battle of Princeton, not after the Battle of Princeton, but at the Battle of Princeton. And it's often called also the death of General Mercer, because the full painting has some figures at Washington's side, including a figure at the bottom which is representing General Mercer, who was bayoneted and died. But Washington didn't complain about having that flag in his picture, commonly known as the Trenton flag, given to the State Library of Harrisburg by Benjamin Rush and taken to Mexico by Edward Williams. Interesting, intangible evidence. No documentary evidence. But what we do know is that in the period of time following around the 50th anniversary of the Revolution, the name Betsy Ross was a relevant name in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. We have the pattern for stars. We have the picture by Ellie Wheeler. We have the picture by Samuel Waldo. Subsequently, we have this Bennett story. She was a legend in her own time. She was not a mythological legend. She was not the legend that sprang from the painting by Charles Weisgerber. Thank you very much. Thanks to my cameraman up there. Of course. Questions? Comments? Have we changed anybody's thinking about Betsy? There was Betsy the myth, and then there's the real Betsy. Samuel Waldo painted my great-great-great-grandmother and called her Bessie Ross. Ellie Wheeler painted three men and a child and a flag and a lady with a flag, you know, well before Charles Weisgerber and well before the speech by William Canby. So it's a long story. Question. Yes.
So I have a question. It may be direct answers at Betsy Ross House, because with the concern that maybe not everyone's embracing the Betsy Ross story, how do you handle that for visitors to the Betsy Ross House? And what kind of feedback have you heard? And does this give you more ammunition to deal with it?
Well, you know, it's a very complicated story, so it's very difficult to tell then text panels which are presented in the house. What we try to do is actually you know, concentrate more on the story of her life than the legend, and we're careful with the wording that we use, like, which we say we presume, we think it, you know, we do call it a legend. We just try to be careful with the wording. It's a very complicated
story. I realize that, yeah.
It's, you know, we try to tell them who her husband and children work as an upholsterer.
What about the story of that it's not actually her house? Was it renumbering in the streets, the bulldozing of that lot?
Right, well, that house, the houses before that have been torn down, like, well into the mid-19th century. And people really didn't really go to the house. But we are careful in our brochure, we actually say that it may not. may have been a house that she lived in as well. So it is very difficult. So because it was purchased as, you know, by the Memorial Association as a house, we were left with it. We do have a 1740s house on the cemetery. We hope that if there was a house next to it that she did live in, we hope that it's similar from the structure. But we are honest. If someone asks me a question, we really don't know what the tax records would try to go back into any documents that might present it. The name is listed on houses next door and back. And we just don't know.
There's a question down there. Young lady in the blue shirt.
That's your house?
What's? Greystone Street?
Griscom
Street? In Frankfurt?
Somebody had said that her name was once Griscom.
Well, Betsy Ross's parents were Griscom.
That's what it was. Her maiden name was Griscom.
Her maiden name was Griscom. And there is a Griscom Street in Frankfurt.
Yes.
I've presented this now maybe three times, four times, and they've been, my group has been a flag group, flag enthusiasts, and the response has been, well, I guess maybe Hopkinson didn't do that flag, you know. But they didn't believe the Betsy Ross story when I started my presentation, but I think I won a few of them over. Yeah. But the idea that Hopkinson's design was adopted is an awfully hard idea to overcome. And if you're going to give the credit to Hopkinson, then you're denying the honesty of the lady Betsy in saying that this committee of three people called on me and I made a flag for George Washington. Now there's, that story comes down to us through her children and nieces and they all believed it. So if you want to deny Betsy's honesty and deny the honesty of her descendants and credit Hopkinson with the flag, then the design of the flag, and maybe Betsy stitched it for Hopkinson, then you have an entirely different scenario. And you have this little old lady in her weakened memory has visualized this handsome Washington as the man who came to see her, when in fact it was this 5-foot-tall Hopkinson. And I don't want to take away from Hopkinson. He was a very important person, as all those men were in those years. We were blessed to have talent like that who got together. I was talking with a gentleman yesterday who portrays George Washington, and he said that Jefferson claimed, we've given Jefferson the credit for writing the Declaration of Independence, but it was first offered to John Adams to write. He said no. Then it was offered to Franklin to write, and he said no. And Jefferson was the new kid or the young kid on the block, so he got the job. But when he presented his draft, they made 25 changes in it, so we still gave him the credit for it. But those were interesting times and interesting men.
Yes. Have you ever been authenticated? I know you said that it's a private collection. And, you know, the signing on the back, has an expert ever looked at that painting to authenticate it?
Several. Several people have looked at it who could authenticate it.
Do you have documentation of events to support that painting?
I'm sorry?
Like, who authenticated it?
I don't know the names of the people that authenticated it, but I can tell you that the gentleman who owns it is one who would check that out very carefully. He would not take that for granted.
I mean, you're right that it's critical.
Yes.
Because
is that right?
There are several sub-stories. One of the sub-stories is just, when does the story get invented or passed along? So, if you can say, well, a lot of people say Canby made it up, which is what the Wall Street Journal article had. And if you can show that Canby didn't make it up, that it predates him with a painting from 1850, then that solves one. That's one piece. The other is if you can show that Hopkinson was unlikely to be the designer, that's another piece of it. It still doesn't. There's nothing affirmative about Betty, but what you are doing is you're chipping away at the deconstruction of her story.
Yeah.
Well, I've always been struck by the fact that she's known as Betsy Ross and not Betsy Claypool, because it's the Claypool line that really does promote the story. And, you know, but they refer to her as Ross, and it would have been better for them to refer to her as a Claypool in terms of, like, their own prominence in society, et cetera. And so it's really fascinating to me that she's known as Betsy Ross, which is the name she had when she made the flag.
But the affidavits speak to that. So for some reason, whether she did or didn't do the flag, she was known in her family as Betsy Ross. For whatever the reason, it has nothing to do with the making of the flag, per se. In other words, the affidavits were clear that this seemed to be her familiar name within the family.
Well, can you speak to that?
I can't answer that. I'd have to go back and read through those affidavits. You're mentioning the affidavits.
I've never been struck by that, but I will go back and look at them and see if she had her name like that.
Let me just make an interesting point here, that one of the three ladies who submitted these affidavits was a lady by the name of Boggs. She was the daughter of Sarah Griscom, Betsy's older sister. Sarah Griscom died in 1793 of the yellow fever, whatever it was, and the 13-year-old child of Sarah came into Betsy's family at age 13. At age 18, she married Donaldson. Donaldson must have... I'm probably getting this not too clear, but then she became Boggs. And she lived with Betsy until Betsy died, because she was a widow, childless. And then she lived with another family, another lineage, Satterthwaite lineage, and all of these people came forward in 1910 or 1907 or 1908 and did their affidavit saying, we remember Auntie Boggs telling us what Betsy told her. Boggs was with Betsy all of Betsy's working life. And she's one of the affidavits that we don't pay much attention to.
And they constantly refer to her as Auntie Claypool.
Auntie Claypool. Okay.
Always, everything I ever saw was Auntie Claypool.
Okay. But anyway, there's more to this family story than has been published.
Her signature here is Claypool. So it's signed here as Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And when she was... Yeah. But 50 years after the Revolutionary War, people are thinking in terms of Betsy Ross. That little artifact for Pattern for Stars has Betsy Ross on it, spelled S-E-Y, but that name stuck. you know, what happened in that period of time from June of 76 to the Trenton conflicts and then the adoption of the flag. When the Marine Committee adopted the flag, they did not adopt this flag as a Marine flag. They adopted it as the flag of the United States. And we weren't united. United was small u, small s in the resolution. And that flag never caught on. The flag that caught on was the flag that was made for the Pennsylvania Navy, where the stars were in a line. So I think Washington had a flag made by Betsy Ross. Rebecca Young testifies to that. Rebecca, yeah. And Bennett. And Washington had that flag at crossing the Delaware. Lutz, the German artist, lived in Philadelphia during the period of the 50th anniversary. He came here as an infant with his parents and lived in Philadelphia for 15, 18 years. Would have absorbed the same kind of folklore that Ellie Wheeler absorbed, the same folklore that Edward Williams absorbed, the same folklore that the folklore that was out there. And it always was Betsy Ross. At any rate, so Emanuel Lutz goes back to Germany and paints Crossing the Delaware with this 13-star flag. If Washington did have it, it is the flag that Betsy made for him. It is the flag that the Marine Committee was examining and comparing with other designs, possible designs, and they adopted it. By 1783, when Thompson wanted the various states to adopt this flag and make it more prominent, they didn't. It was too difficult to make it. Everybody had converted to the straight lines. All the flags from that point on were straight line flags. Well, I could go on for another 20 minutes, but you folks have been very generous. Thank you all.
That's a lot of research together. Yeah, it's a lot of history.